I don't like the chairs over here either.
Yeah, you just can saying. Totally have your chair.
No, that's fine. It's all good. It's fine.
Once you give up your chair, though, you also give up the right to be like, it's fine.
No, I know. I get it. I know. Oh, guess we're enough studio complaining.
they've figured us out.
All right, here we go. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always, by you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
So a couple of things you need to know before we start this. Number one, my mom's in town, so I'm a little crabby. Number two, it's true. Number two, Molly and I are in the same place for a change doing this podcast. No, I love my mom.
But so
she's in town,
and
it's been like 4 days. Come on.
2 days out from Mother's Day,
Hit me up on Twitter if you can feel my pain.
For those of you who are going to be hearing this a little later, 2 days out from Mother's Day, the day drinking from brunch is worn off.
Anyway, all right, so we'll get down to it, actually. For the last couple of months, we've been talking on and off about data privacy because of Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and all of that and what it means for us. Today, though, we have a guest talking about solutions to it, or I guess probably really the way to say it is part of a solution because it's a much bigger problem than that. Laura Noreen is a professor, a data scientist. She teaches a class called Ethics for Data Science at NYU.
And we really thought it was going to be one of those hopeful solution-based conversations. No, I will preface this by saying that at one point during the interview, there may have been a message sent from me to the team saying, dark place alert. Because, as always, when you talk about the morass we're in with respect to morality in the tech industry, things get a little dark. But yeah. I'm hopeful.
Hopeful's good.
We will have, of course, the collective wisdom platform part of the show, listener reactions, a lot of threads that we've been pulling, and mm-hmm. you guys have lots of thoughts on them that are all smart, including the conversation last week with Glenn Weil and his radical ideas about free markets. The book's called Radical Markets. You guys should have known from the title that these ideas would be provocative.
Would be provocative. I have to tell you, by the way, I haven't heard that yet because I was, what was I doing? Oh, I was in Columbus, Georgia, doing some reporting. All right. Anyway, here you go. First things first. All right. Fixation fix.
The fixation fix. Do you have one?
I do. It's blank. I know it's blank on the rundown. I'll tell you the truth when we get to my turn, but you go first.
Oh, I see. Kai's going to be a surprise. My fixation this week is sort of Facebook related, even though I think we're probably over-rotating on Facebook, but I think that
stop. Do you really?
Yeah, compared to the rest of the tech industry, compared to like the data economy overall.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's sort
totally.
Of,
yep.
It's just really easy to get caught up in what Facebook is doing. But what I do think is interesting is watching them over-rotate on the reaction. And so one of the things that they did this week was put out this report saying, you know, here are all the ways that we try to clean up Facebook in the last quarter.
Yeah.
And we took down almost a billion Facebook posts that were spam.
Wow.
Like 856 million of them in Q1 2018. They did not say how many similar posts they took down in the last quarter.
We don't compare. Billions a lot, but
And this is right. So this is the really interesting part is that they're like, let's give you this data dump. But none of that data dump is about misinformation or fake news. They didn't say how many fake news stories they took down, just spam. I did think it was interesting that a minority of those posts were hate speech, nudity, which we know Facebook hates, graphic violence, or terrorist content. No examples of the graphically violent posts, those types of things that they took down. And this is what I found really interesting, just this sort of ongoing reliance on AI as the way to solve the sort of trash problem that Facebook has, which is like if a billion posts are spam, then computers can definitely deal with this problem. And we need all your data so we can continue to build this awesome AI that can filter out the spam.
You always say, the answer from Facebook is always more Facebook.
Yes, exactly. In this case, it's an AI that requires ever more data. And it's interesting to me because I was just at a conference talking. I was on this little round table with a bunch of startup CEOs talking about how to use data to leverage your growth. And I was like, I got a show. I want it to grow. Like, let's talk.
Yeah. So did you learn anything?
Yeah. What I learned is that even these hardcore data quants think more people need to be involved. It was fascinating. Yeah, there was one guy, and it's an off-the-record conversation, I can't tell you. But one guy who's like a hardcore data scientist from Microsoft and beyond, he said, I got into this business thinking I'm going to kill the business hunch because AI is going to get so good. Right. And what I realized is, no, you have to have data-driven insights that come from humans. Right. And so they were talking about – essentially how to build more art into the algorithms.
Wow, that's cool.
It was
right?
Really a relief for some of the people in the room who are storytellers. But it also, I wonder if they are a vanguard or if this, or if Facebook, you know, like, does Facebook not see this? They don't think we need humans in the loop? Or is it just an excuse to get more data? I don't know.
I think it depends on how many people down the chain at Facebook can convince Zuckerberg that they need more people in the loop, right?
I guess so. But you know, clearly doesn't think so, which is something that we all need to keep in mind. Like, he still wants to sell more ads, and he doesn't think people are in the loop. And then related to this, I've been watching a lot of live TV lately because it's playoff season. And
basketball, by the way. She's basketball. A basketball fan.
I do mean, I mean the NBA. I'm pretty sure that there were some Stanley Cup playoffs too in there. So, like, you're going to get an email.
There are.
But I was, thank you. Good save. My mom called me. I don't know. I didn't know what was happening with hockey. So, I've been seeing a lot of live commercials.
Yes.
And
oh,
in one
how's that working for you?
30 second or in 1 2-minute commercial break, I saw two apology ads.
Is that right?
One from Facebook. And one from Wells Fargo.
Wow.
And I actually, and I'm so excited, I prepared, we have prepared, I didn't, Chris Olin, prepared a clip from the Facebook apology ad that is running on national TV during the NBA playoffs. Go!
We came here for the friends.
Aww.
And we got to know the friends of our friends.
Aww.
And then our old friends from middle school, our mom, our ex, and our boss. And we found others just like us.
Just like us, Kai. Oh, they were just like us.
It's like, just like that, we felt a little less alone.
Oh,
Jesus. This is
but then something happened.
In an amazing
we had to deal with spam, clickbait, fake news,
fake
and
news.
Data misuse.
Data misuse!
That's going to change. From now on, Facebook will do more to keep you safe and protect your privacy.
Wow.
So we can all get back to what made Facebook good in the first place. Friends.
Friends. That was like a
when
birthday
this place
party.
Does what it was built
there's like
for,
a baby right there.
Then we all get a little closer.
Is
that
amazing?
Is amazing.
And so,
oh my God.
What, in your long experience in business and economics, what prompts an apology ad of that level and complexity and cost?
Wanting to convince people that this terrible thing you did wasn't so terrible.
Do you think that means they're quitting?
Wow, no.
Well, but why else would you, why do you need to convince them? Is it to stave off regulation? Is it to get new users? Is it because people are leaving? I don't know. I was just like, what?
I don't know. I don't think people are leaving. Look, since this whole thing came down with Cambridge Analytica and all that, and I've said this, right? I deleted Facebook. I deleted the app from my phone and from my iPad. Mm-hmm. And so I rarely go on. But when I do, I'm not seeing a decrease in postings of random, you know, puppy videos or whatever.
Yeah, I do know a lot of people who have said that exact sentence though, which is I rarely go on. So it's possible that people aren't leaving, but that the engagement is much lower. I don't know, but I'm super curious about sort of the economics of the apology ad. Like what when do, because Facebook, as we know, has been apologizing to America for 14
for
years.
14 years, right? Yeah.
So what is it that puts them over? And also, I super want to know if they got permission for all of the clips and posts that they used in this commercial, because they're all like people.
God,
it's all like, babe,
right?
Wouldn't that be the greatest story ever? Yeah, like, BuzzFeed should totally go and find out that. Actually, producer Eve, this is so fun, by the way. I can see all the people.
I know. So we have to tell you the setup here. So first of all, Molly and I are in the same room. Second of all, I'm sitting in the guest chair because I'm actually off today, not doing Marketplace. So Molly's in the big chair. And that means she can see the control room and all those people behind me who it's like four or five people. It's
and they're
kind
doing
of
all this fun stuff like they're waving. She was like, what we can call Facebook is what they pantomime.
They,
now they're
they
dancing.
Laugh and they do awkward. No dancing.
Aw.
Well, a guy takes a day off and all of a sudden there's dancing.
Here.
What?
Because they know I like to dance and I'm the one who can see them. This is great. Okay. I sneaked like a whole minute worth of sound into my fixation. So I think it's your turn.
No. So look, here's the thing that I've been actually thinking about, and it's been a couple of days now, and it's shockingly about trade policy and the president of the United States.
No way.
I'm sure. I know. Shocking. You data me trade policy. Go figure. You data me trade policy. I just want to point something out here, and that is this. And I've said from the beginning of the Trump administration, if not earlier, that, look, the global economy is hard and it's really tough. And you have to do a lot of things that don't necessarily make sense if you want things to work. And as we've seen for the past 18 months of the Trump administration, his response has been, no, it's not hard. I'm just going to pull back and we're going to do things my way and the hell with y'all, in essence, has been his thing. And then 2 days ago, maybe three, He comes out with this tweet about the Chinese telecommunications company ZTE,
yes,
which is under serious, like, existential sanctions from the United States of America for its violations and for lying to the Department of Commerce about what it was doing in terms of intellectual property and data manipulation and also invasion of privacy and IP theft and also spying. And so they were facing really serious, like, kill-the-company sanctions that would have prevented them from doing business in the United States. And then 2 days ago, the president of the United States says on Twitter, hey, I'm working with Xi Jinping to get ZTE back up and save Chinese jobs. And it was mind-boggling because, mm-hmm. because oh my God, because that's literally almost what he said. And I just want to point out that, first of all, there's a couple of layers to this. One, yes, there are Chinese jobs at stake, but also American jobs at stake, because a lot of the components that go into ZTE telecommunications gear are American-made. So Americans are working on this. But also, it's not a zero-sum game. Global trade and negotiation is, look, you give a little, I give a little, steel tariffs, ZTE jobs, help with North Korea, take your pick. And look, I think it's kind of bananas that the president of the United States is personally intervening in a law enforcement matter, which is what the ZTE sanction case was.
Right.
But I, and here it is on the record, I think it's actually promising that he's realizing that there are that is a multilateral process, that there are many facets and many faces to these problems that he, until 2 days ago, was very do it my way or the highway. And that's it. That's all I got. That's my fix.
So you see this as a step toward negotiation and diplomacy.
I think it is promising
that
he is doing these things that take into account other people's needs and wants, because Xi Jinping wants this company to succeed. He wants those 70,000 Chinese jobs or whatever it is. The whole law enforcement thing is kind of bad. And if I were an American intellectual property law enforcement lawyer, I'd be really pissed mm-hmm. because the president of the United States is undercutting you. But look, if this means we don't have a trade war with the second largest economy in the world, then maybe that's a plus.
Yeah.
All right. So All right. That's my fix.
That's what we got. Let us know what your fixation is. You know, just little stuff. Let us know what your fixations are these days of the news variety, please. Keep it cool, people. Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can go to our website at makemesmart.org or tweet us at Kai Rizdahl and at Molly Wood, because no, we have not abandoned the Twitter. And now, a musical interlude.
Which we'll try not to step on. Oh, dancing. Oh, my God. It's more like bopping in your chair.
It's just bopping. It's more like a wiggle. This could not really even be called a dance. For weeks now, as you know, we have been, all of us, everyone together, has been talking about the problems with companies handling our personal data. And so we thought, and we've gotten, I think actually this idea came from, I feel like, an email from someone saying, it was totally one of you saying, what about ethics? And what about this idea of teaching ethics to computer scientists, which is what it all ultimately comes down to. And a few weeks ago, I said that computer science as a field has not had this moral reckoning. And this did come from a tweet, the way that other sciences have, like nuclear physics with the atomic bomb. And as it turns out, there are people grappling with the social implications of big data. And some of them are even spreading this message to the children. Thank God. Professor Laura Noreen is one of those people. She's at NYU. In addition to her own research and writing, she teaches a course there called Ethics for Data Science, which is not computer science at large, but the science of manipulating all this data, which is kind of what's going on now. So we started off by talking with her about how she came to teach this class.
It's an interesting story. So New York University, where I teach, started a Center for Data Science 5 or 6 years ago. And after they had started it, they got a big grant to expand data science, to make it radically interdisciplinary. You know, all different disciplines are going to be using these methods, from political science to genetics to physics. Just every discipline that you could imagine is probably going to be using new methods. And they thought maybe they should bring on a social scientist just to study that process, just to see how it works, to bring all these different disciplines together around methods. And my job was kind of to watch that process unfold, and as I saw things that maybe could be addressed differently, raise my hand and say, hey, we should do this differently. And one of the things I raised my hand and said was, hey, I think we should probably teach ethics. You know, we're arming our students with some pretty powerful tools and really not a lot of contextual insight into how those tools are going to be used and deployed. And I think last week or a couple of weeks ago, there was a paper presented about predicting gang activity in Los Angeles. And the social scientists in the room said, hey, do you have any idea how this is going to be used or what kind of impact this is going to have on these communities? You're actually using out-of-date maps. Like, haven't these gangs kind of moved around and changed some? Like, this could go badly wrong. And the poor person presenting the paper said, oh, I'm just an engineer. I don't really know about that.
Wow.
And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to present so that we don't put our students in a bad position where they think that they can behave as just an engineer. And that, you know, they really do use data science in sensitive and contextual ways.
So not to make it all about the class, but on day one of the class, how do you start? What's the opening? Welcome to class, students. And this semester we're going to be fill in the blank.
This semester we're going to be investigating how you can apply your data science methods effectively to both maximize benefits and minimize harms. It's a little bit of the Hippocratic Oath.
I was just going to say, it sounds very Hippocratic.
With a maximize benefits in there. Because I think, so if we look for a moment, if you don't mind me going off the rails a little bit, the European Union has really decided that one of the ways they're going to lead in data science is around ethics and their general data protection regulation that's coming into effect later this month. Well, I mean, it exists already, but it's becoming much stronger later this month. Is a version of what I call a kind of delete and retreat model of data science ethics, and that does empower users to have a more relational situation with the platforms that are gathering data on them, but I'm not sure that it will fully maximize benefits. I mean, there are many things we can do better if we do them with data science. So deleting and retreating may not actually get us there as quickly or efficiently as we may otherwise get. But these relationships are really difficult to manage, and I can understand why they have decided that deleting and the right to be forgotten is more ethical than what we have now. Yeah. It might be, but I'm not sure that it's in fact the very best strategy for, you know, like if you want to get to self-driving cars as quickly as possible, which will probably save many lives, deleting a bunch of data is probably not going to get us there quickly.
Right.
We'll get there eventually.
Yeah, so run with that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's like the really interesting argument right now as as companies and researchers are trying to develop fully fledged AI and machine learning algorithms that can cure diseases or predict pandemics or create self-driving cars, that there is a lot of good. And so what is the alternative? What is the ethical way to feed those machines?
I think it's important, or it's been instructive for me to figure out how did we get to this point where users are coming to companies and saying, hey, I'd like you to delete my data. Just delete data. Don't, you know, I'm going to delete Facebook, which actually nobody really seems to have done. But they thought about it and they tweeted about it. So there's something there. I think what happened is we went down an ethical dead end when we decided that the relationships companies like Facebook and Twitter and Tesla are going to have with users is all written in terms of service that nobody can understand and privacy policies that nobody can understand, and therefore nobody reads them. And that offers some legal compliance, legal protection against things, but it doesn't really offer any human understanding of what's going on. And it leads to this moment where, you know, enough funky things have happened. You know, Uber runs someone over in Arizona. Facebook may be somehow rewriting how democracy is done. We're now at a moment where we're saying we don't want that. But the only strategies that we have as users are to just quit. And that is impoverished. But that's I think what we talk about when we talk about privacy is really a lack of empowerment for users. They really have no, like, what could they possibly do? They can't even understand the terms of service, even if they wanted to educate themselves, which mm-hmm. kind of violates the older principles of informed consent. Informed consent means you actually have to inform people before they can consent to what you're doing. And nobody's mm-hmm. informed by terms of service or privacy policies, except, you know, extremely well-trained lawyers who specialize in that. And that doesn't really describe all of the users. So I think we're getting to a moment now where we're going to have to think about what does a more ethical consenting procedure look like that's very different than terms of service. And the EU's general data protection regulation does get at that a little. It sort of forces companies to write their terms of service in language that normal people can understand.
Yeah, it would be totally nice. But how realistic do you think it is? I mean, Zuckerberg, I think, said, you know, we're going to comply with the spirit, right, of GDPR. Well, how's that going to play out over here so that American consumers can enjoy the same levels of protection that consumers, you know, in Europe and probably eventually a bunch of the rest of the world are going to benefit from?
Yeah, well, I mean, so Americans have very different understandings of what privacy means than Europeans do. Americans are a little bit more open with their data, and they're a lot more willing to make the trade-off, like, well, I'll give you some of my data for free if you give me an awesome service that I don't have to pay for. And I think we should take that seriously. I don't think that's, you know, people who have a false consciousness about what they're doing. I think for a lot of people that works out pretty well, and they're actually okay with that trade-off. So we may not want to kind of import European ideas of privacy into the U.S. or into China or any other country. Huh. Morals and ethics are actually highly culturally specific. But one example that I like a lot, the difference between, say, a Facebook and a Twitter for me is that when you interact with Twitter, it's very obvious that all of your data and all of your tweets are going to be public because it is possible to just put someone's, you know, Twitter.com and their Twitter handle in, and you can see everything they've ever tweeted. You didn't have to log in. You didn't have to give them that's a very, like, built into their design admission that what you're doing on that platform is very public. And that's very different than what happens on Facebook. You can't really see anything unless you log in. And they have tried very hard to have kind of 31 flavors of privacy.
So kind of broadly, as you approach this question, though, of building in data and or building in ethics and morality as you build these businesses, is it too, you know, in your mind, is it too late for Facebook? Are you just going to have to train sort of a new generation of business leaders to think about these issues? Or is there going to be enough pressure in some way on Facebook?
Oh, I do worry about Facebook because I'm not sure that they're able to do enough soul searching to understand where they need to go next. And I think also their mm-hmm. business model is based on, you know, they've been very clear all along that Facebook will always remain free for users. And that's a very wise business choice for them in the sense that they know who their customers are. It's advertisers. And they can optimize their platform to satisfy those customers so long as they can keep bringing in the users. And, they know who's where in this hierarchy. Advertisers are going to be above users. They're clearly, even if they have fairly substantial scandals, if you can call Cambridge Analytica the most recent thing that happened with them a scandal, their users don't quit. So they seem to have gotten themselves into, at least in terms of their business model, they've gotten themselves into a pretty sweet spot. And I don't know that there's going to be enough pressure to get them to change that. And technically, it would be very difficult for them to move to some kind of ongoing consenting procedure where I'm asked all the time when I log in, you know, would you like to have a relationship with this new company you've never heard of? We'd like to advertise their products to you, and we think you want, you know, overnight business attire picked out by an algorithm.
Well, so along those lines, actually, how much of a problem is it for those of you who try to instill ethics in data science? How much of a problem is it that there are tens of millions of people out there who go, meh, whatever?
It's a big problem. I mean, the risk of a class like this is that it just becomes a check-the-box experience. Yeah. You know, like, I have to sit here and it's kind of fun to talk about this stuff, and then I'm going to go on and pay no attention to it in the future.
Which
and it feels like it's not...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, to add to that, it's not just that the users are giving a collective shrug, but that the people in your class, these future business leaders, are going, Mark Zuckerberg is... one of the richest men on earth.
Right. I want to be like him.
Why would I do your way and potentially be concessionary? So to what extent do you have to sort of teach people? And I imagine it's almost impossible in the environment that you just described, but do you have to teach people that ethical business behavior is also a good business decision?
Yeah. I mean, I've taught ethics in the business school or some flavor of something. We don't call it ethics because people tend to find that a little boring.
In the business school? That's good to know. That's great. That's lovely. Great. We'll have you on Marketplace in a couple of weeks. Christ almighty.
Yeah. What do you call it?
We call it business and it's Publix. How do you do something other than make profit with a business? And how do you have that wake you up in the morning? And we teach them that as freshmen as a required course. So, and they're 18 years old, so or 19. They don't know anything better, so we like to get the good habits in there before they have any bad habits. We bring up Milton Friedman only to sort of convince them that he was a little short-sighted in his ideas of how businesses should relate to society. And frankly, since my data science ethics class right now is not required, I'm only getting students who are motivated to be there, and they are fantastic. So the class is great. They're all very motivated to you know, take more social science, work with domain experts so that they're not, you know, a data scientist who actually has no experience with, say, criminal justice, making some algorithm that's going to determine who gets bail or who doesn't get bail.
With all the conversations that we're having now about data privacy and responsibility and ethics and who ought to be doing what, what's the thing nobody's talking about that you know about?
Well, the neuroscientists among us are talking about ethics for people who have or will have, some people already do have, augmented cognition. So right now, you guys have probably heard about cochlear implants.
Yeah, for so people who are hard of hearing,
Right, but that type of technology where you can put, you can go into someone's brain and make them perceive things that they wouldn't have been able to perceive otherwise, can be used in other applications. You can, you know, imagine giving someone night vision. You know, we don't have night vision. That's not a thing humans have. But cats have it, so we can model that, and then we can maybe give people night vision. And other kinds of cognitive enhancements like that. Those are much farther afield at the moment. But that kind of thing brings up all sorts of interesting ethical questions. Like, are we going to then amplify the kind of social inequality we have by cognitive inequality? Some people will just have more capable brains because they can afford to buy these types of implements. Or what if someone wants to demand that all their employees have a certain kind of implement in their brain? You know, yes, it's augmenting, but, you know, like if you join the army, for instance, are you going to have these things? That's kind of the forefront of a niche little area in data science.
I'm obsessed with this. Like the idea that we will create a class of people who are faster, better, stronger, live longer, are healthier. Anyway, sorry.
Yep.
Yes. I think that whole conversation about sort of transhumanism and equality is another show.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's a whole different interview.
Yeah, it's a whole nother show.
I thought that was totally interesting. It's scary, right? I go back to the whole people in the class looking at Zuckerberg and going, what are you going to do? Are you going to make a whole lot of money, or are you going to be a good person? Which is not to imply that Mark Zuckerberg is not a good person. But,
right.
but.
Well, it's hard not to have the takeaway that nobody's going to care that much about ethics until it makes money. And there are
that's a better way to put
there
it.
Are
yes.
positive trend lines in that direction. There was a story, actually, I've been staying in a hotel, so I'm getting the USA Today.
Oh,
so yesterday
yeah.
there was a USA Today story about millennials who are saving and who are directing their 401k investments to be in, you know, more social good companies, or taking investments out of oil companies or gun companies. Or and so I think that there is that sense on the horizon, and there's this kind of upcoming generation who believes that a socially responsible company is really powerful. There's even some stat about how they think it's more powerful than voting to like buy socially responsible products.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a capitalist answer to that.
Yeah, maybe.
Question?
I'm just trying to think of a market-based solution for ethics, right? I mean, we tried market-based solutions for I can't even tell you how many different things, right? Carbon and pollution and you know, whatever, tolls and roads and all this jazz.
Yeah.
I don't know if a market-based solution for ethics. This is honestly, all right, here it is.
That's a great question.
And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to the crowd, doing the wisdom of the crowd. Make me smart, because honestly, that's what this is about. There's somebody out there who's got a better answer on market-based solution for ethics than me sitting here, you know, pulling it out of nowhere, as it were. Speaking of money, though, that's what we got to do. How about that, huh?
Amazing.
I've been doing radio for a while now.
So smooth.
That was a good little thing. I like that one.
Dear Make Me Smart.
My name's Jessica from Austin.
This is Stephen Gillivray from Fountain Hills, Arizona.
This is Sandra Bond in Newport, Oregon.
All right, keeping on going. More OU.
More. Coincidentally, or not, considering the ongoing nature of this conversation, we have listener mail that relates to the conversation we just heard with data ethicist Laura Noreen. This voice memo actually came in a few days before we spoke with Laura.
Devin Ramdutt wants more transparency around advertising. He says social media political ads had such little oversight, and I imagine he's talking about this past election, and he wants to know more about not just which organization is placing any given ad, but who paid for it. Here you go, Devin Ramdutt.
If I saw a political ad on my Facebook feed with a note that indicated that 60% of the funding for that ad came from individuals or an organization based in Russia, it would allow me to view that ad in a much more critical light. I understand the difficulties of sometimes identifying those sources of funding, but this is why I think the conversation needs to shift towards discussions about how we improve our monitoring and detection of such acts and how we provide more transparency to the American people when they view ads that are political or politically motivated.
Yes, but getting from here to there is kind of, you know, that's devil's in the details, right?
Kind of, but it's not that hard. I think Facebook did announce some steps in this direction. Yeah. Actually, they are going to make it a little more transparent who bought an ad. And look, we have these rules on television and broadcast.
I approve this message.
I approve this message. And you have to say, even if it is a political action committee that is well and truly hidden in terms of its actual motivations, they do have to register. Like there are sunlight laws. And so it is not that hard. And it's overdue on social media. It speaks to the publisher versus platform situation, which is that they have not been considered a publisher and haven't had these rules until now.
This is all about regulation of these places. And we've had conversations about this and how it's going to go. Or having some degree of familiarity with the Congress of the United States, how it's not going to go. I'm just saying.
Maybe we could get that one guy interested in this topic. You know, the one. Okay.
Yeah.
Arda Ungen wrote in when we first brought up the idea that ethics should be taught in the realm of computer science and said, I just finished a computer science degree at UC Santa Barbara, and one of the required courses was ethics and engineering. He says change is coming in the pipeline, but it's pretty much too little too late. Never say that.
Well,
Life is long.
But you're right. But so much of this is baked in now, right? I mean, going back to your, you have to tell your 10-year-old to wash his hair and scrub with his fingernails or whatever it is, right?
Finger pads, apparently.
It is pads, not nails. And your thought is that that's where we are with tech and these companies, right? Mm-hmm. I think actually what's happening now is much like Eli is learning how to wash his hair and will wash it that way for the rest of his life, the habits that tech companies are in now are becoming ingrained and will be very hard to break.
Yes, but that is where the consumer pressure thing comes in, because if Eli grows up and meets a nice woman or man who wants him to wash his hair differently and really insists upon that behavior change, you know, it could happen. And we have that. I hope that we do at some point have that. I'm holding out hope that seeing that Facebook apology ad on TV,
means which was amazing,
that those of us consumers are actually starting. Because, look, I want Facebook. My grandmother died recently, and my cousin, we're not having a funeral until later, and my cousin set up this private group for memories of my grandmother. And it has been incredible. It is, like, cathartic. My mom has this treasure trove of photos from, like, Dust Bowl Canada in the 20s of my grandmother and her family. And it is incredible. And this is what it is for and should be for and should allow us to do when we're spread from Montana to California
to Alaska.
Wait, you
guys, play that ad. Play the ad. Play the ad underneath her now.
You know.
We came here for the friends.
We get a little teary. It allows us to be closer together. And I have the right as a consumer to demand a better product. I do. And that has worked over the years.
And your choice as a consumer, if you don't get that better product, be it a loaf of bread or a slice of meat or a hamburger bun, is to go somewhere else.
Exactly.
And yet the problem is there ain't no place else with Facebook.
We could be group texting this, though. I mean, we could. You know?
Why aren't you?
I don't know, because we default
at the
moment
the first
to Facebook. And it was – right. But I will say that my friends who are not, you know, my less tech-savvy cousins in Montana are –
nothing bad about the people in Montana.
Our only right. Nope. You're all. I'm Montanans related to most of you, so you're awesome.
let's
keep it straight. There's a lot of cousins. I'm just saying, and not that many people. But I do have friends who, you know, just went on a big school field trip. Right. All my friends who just chaperoned a field trip, they put it all in an Apple like photos album.
Huh.
And none of it's on Facebook. So I am seeing behavior changes that I am holding out hope for.
You go be the cutting edge.
So much hope. Right. Springs eternal, they say.
All right. Listener Katie Rogers left us a voicemail hoping to learn more about some very edgy ideas around voting and democracy, about which, by the way, we have also been talking. Here you go.
Hi, Molly and Kai.
Hi, Katie.
I'm moving back to Indiana from southern Georgia and have been lamenting the state of politics in the area, so I started digging. I came across Nathan Altman's campaign for U.S. Senate and his Free the Ballot initiative. Indiana doesn't make it easy for independents. They have to hand collect almost 27,000 verifiable signatures just to get on the ballot. While I was researching Altman, I was introduced to the idea of liquid democracy. I'd love for you to discuss liquid democracy. I can't help but think we're due for an upgrade, but would like your opinion on the idea. And do you think we'll ever break Duverger's law and have enough independence to matter? Thanks.
Could I just say, could I just point out a very teeny tiny producer fail right here? I know there's a little bit of responsibility on the part of those of us sitting in front of the microphones to look advanced in what we're going to be talking about today. But Duverger's law is a new one. Yeah. Well, liquid democracy and the whole concept of it's not just majority. It's first past the post. It's you can pick two like we're doing here in California. It's a whole bunch of variations on.
None of those words made any sense to me.
So it's,
I mean,
it's,
the individual words
it's
did.
It's not just Duverger's law, but the idea of liquid democracy. Right.
Right.
It's not just who gets the most votes wins. It's you pick one through four and you rank order then.
It's ranked voting.
It's also
a bunch of different things, apparently.
Right.
So yeah, I at least got a heads up about liquid democracy and I duck-duck-goed it. So I do know that it can also involve delegating your vote. Because Glenn Weil talked about the idea of one voter, one vote, one person, one vote, and getting rid of that. And liquid democracy does seem to be a step in that direction where you could delegate a vote to a more knowledgeable person.
Uh-huh. We also don't have one person, one vote in this country, right? I mean, if you look at the different sizes of congressional districts and if you look at the Senate in the United States and, you know, some person in Montana versus some person in California,
like my vote counts like 1/16th as much as somebody in. Yes.
So really what we ought to do, and this is, I guess, an extension of is capitalism working for enough people? Is democracy, right? Because we've done the whole is democracy failing capitalism thing. But we should look at how to make democracy work for more people.
Also, there's a connection between liquid democracy and blockchain.
Oh, you're just pulling that out of your tech.
Hootie,
man.
That's totally true.
I'm going to throw this in there. Blockchain.
Ding.
Market blockchain place.
Drink. Take a sip of your GDPR every time I say blockchain. But it would be a way for you to delegate your vote in an open, transparent, and totally secure fashion. Because blockchain's the answer to everything.
So let me just say, rounding it back up and getting back to my mom's in town, when I was growing up and we would talk about elections in my house, this is a true story, and once again, my mother doesn't listen to this podcast, so I can say this. I would say, who are you voting for, Mom? And Mom would say, oh, whoever your father tells me to vote for. Look, Mom was married at 19.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's intense.
Yeah.
And also totally still.
Well, crazy, right?
Okay. I'm not going to say that because I'm pretty sure Hillary just got in trouble for saying
same
Hillary
thing. Hillary gets in all kinds of trouble.
Essentially.
Yeah.
But
she can't turn around without getting in trouble.
Well, all of that is happening to some extent in that people are saying, I'm just going to vote for the Republican or I'm just going to vote for the Democrat. And and that even doesn't mean what it's like, which kind of Republican are you going to vote for? Or which Democrat? Like the Davos one or like the human one? You know, I don't know, it's all over the place.
Yep.
Anyway, blockchain.
All right. Anyway. Where are we? All right, we're going to wrap it up. Yes, Caroline Hunter sent in her answer to the Make Me Smart question from the state of Massachusetts. Recently got her MBA. Congratulations.
Woohoo.
And wants to focus on developing leadership at companies. Oh, don't we all? End of parenthetical remark there. Here's what she said was something she thought she knew but later found out she was wrong about it. Here you go, Caroline Hunter.
Hi, Kai and Molly. Something I thought I knew but found out I did not was that once I got my MBA, I would stop having self-doubt. What I've learned since then is that my doubt is what causes me to question and ultimately to get smarter with other people who are doing the same, such as the listeners to this podcast. Thank you for hosting.
Aww.
Oh, and thank you for writing. That was nice.
That was really nice. And yes, that I love that. That was like such an old people groan on our part. Like, oh, honey, education does not remove doubt. Yeah. If anything, it just creates more. But it is valuable, I think, being a questioner. It's the key. Caroline did say, though, that the most rewarding part of her MBA experience was finding her role in helping people stay human in big corporate systems.
Which can be really tough. Right?
Honestly, I feel like staying human has kind of been the theme of our whole show.
It can be tough in a small corporate system. just saying.
Yeah. They can all see us. Just keep it cool.
It's radio.
The producers are in the
All right, let's remember the Make Me Smart question, which is, oh my God, I'm sitting in the wrong seat and I can't look at my little cheat sheet, which is right there, and it's facing Molly, so now she's going to read it.
What is something you thought you knew, but then you found out you were wrong about, and now you know? thing. I had to write it down. Man. God, we are learning so much today.
Oh, my God.
I love today. But record your answer because clearly we love it. We love to play your answers and then email them to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And stay human, everyone. I think that's our enduring lesson.
Yes.
From today's show and forever.
Here's another lesson. Go to Apple Podcasts, leave us a review, subscribe, tell your friends. Algorithms help. They make us move up the charts, and charts are everything, yo.
Charts are everything. Data. It's all data.
It is all data. But there was something about, oh, God, you know what I saw today? Which I'm surprised, actually, I didn't see you tweeting out somehow. Philip Morris getting all kinds of data on when people smoke and how they smoke from their new e-cigarette gizmo.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, honestly,
even our vices, are they going to put like a chip in my beer bottle next? Anyway.
Oh, my God, that's fascinating.
Right?
Listen for that as the final on Marketplace today.
Make Me Smart, produced by Sharon Morris and Christopher Olin. Senior producer is Eve Tro. This week's program was engineered by, hang on, yes, Charlton Thorpe. Had to turn around and look. Theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand. Oh, we get to say it during the dancing part. It's the Tara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is dancing Deborah Clark.
If you knew Deborah Clark, you would know that she will object to that. Also, I did not bring enough water to this.
Maybe
studio.
She, like your mom, doesn't listen.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.